Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. One of the topics we come back to repeatedly on Medical Monday is debunking medical myths. As a public, we are bombarded with claims about healthcare, medication, diets, and lifestyle constantly, much of which is not validated scientifically or medically. My guest today, Dr. Jen Gunter, is well known for wielding what she calls the lasso of truth. A funny and wry obstetrician-gynecologist, Gunter is also boarded in pain management and cares for many patients with chronic pelvic pain. Active on social media, Gunter has 250,000 Twitter followers and uses the platform to deflect what she sees as aggressively untruthful marketing claims from companies preying on people's insecurities. Gunter's work has crossed the media spectrum. In addition to social media, she's a regular health columnist for the New York Times, she has her own podcast, and even is the host of a TV show called Gensplaining that runs on the CBC in her native Canada. Gunter's latest book is a bestseller called The Vagina Bible, which to my eyes is a modern version of the 1970 classic Our Bodies Ourselves, which seeks to offer truth about our bodies, sex, and reproduction in straight-ahead, non-judgmental, non-hyperbolic, unapologetic, and unembarrassed language. Dr. Jen Gunter, New York Times columnist, social media enthusiast, and author of The Vagina Bible, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. She spoke to me from her home base in Northern California via Skype. Dr. Jen Gunter, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by asking you about your communication with the public. So you are an obstetrician-gynecologist and have diversified your career into communication of medical concepts to really the general public. What led you in that direction?
Yeah, so I really firmly believe that the health of the public is a physician's concern. And I think that I got to this place because of my own interactions with the healthcare system when my children were born extremely prematurely in 2003 at 26 weeks gestation. And they were in the neonatal intensive care unit for months and had a myriad of really significant health problems. And one of my sons also had a complex cardiac defect that required a procedure pretty quickly after he was born, and then another one and multiple ICU stays. And so I felt firsthand the difficulties of communicating with healthcare providers, and because you see other parents sitting in waiting rooms and you get to know them well. And I realized that I was able to understand on a different level, I think, the communication. You know, doctors would come out and they would say something to a parent, and I'd see the parent would be very upset, and they would have misinterpreted what the doctor said because, you know, we have our medical language and the way we say things. And to another doctor, it sounds one way, and to a patient, it sounds completely differently. And I'd never really seen that, you know, witnessed those kinds of interactions before. And so I started to think a lot about that, like how we communicate and what people take away from that. And then I also spent a lot of time myself trying to find health information online because when your children have problems that medicine can't fix, that's where you go. And I consider myself one of the staunchest proponents of evidence-based medicine. And I found myself sucked down rabbit holes of misinformation. And I made some healthcare decisions with my children that I wished I hadn't in retrospect because of misinformation. So those two things kind of led me to think that when we were kind of through this and I could take a little bit of a breather, that I would see if I could fix the medical internet. And here we are.
Wow, and it's been quite a ride. You are becoming, I would say, or have become, both through your book and through your Twitter presence, a celebrity of sorts in terms of medical truth. You wield the lasso of truth, your slogan on Twitter, which I love. Also, I didn't know that history, and I think it's quite interesting that as a medical professional who's trained and who had a medical education, that even, you know, for your own family, you said you went down these rabbit holes of misinformation or false information. And I guess one of the things you're known for is kind of countering some of the celebrity-driven misinformation that's out there from a number of sources. But perhaps most famously, there's a couple. There's Gwyneth Paltrow, who runs a company called Goop that is sort of a lifestyle brand. And then, of course, there's Dr. Mehmet Oz, who is a cardiothoracic surgeon, has the imprimatur of legitimate medicine and has this daily show, but is often peddling potions and elixirs that aren't what you refer to as evidence-based. He's often criticized in the medical community for selling and promoting things that don't have a lick of solid evidence that they're actually helpful for patients. So how did that just come through Twitter conflict, or was there something about Goop, the Gwyneth Paltrow company, that particularly incensed you?
Oh, well, right off the bat, when I started getting involved online, my attention was turned to sort of the forces of anti-vaccine. Because when you have two children that are vulnerable to vaccine-preventable illnesses, you know, my son had been in the ICU twice with influenza pneumonia by the time he was 3 and a half. You know, you acutely feel how this sort of web of misinformation, you know, it's not only harmful, but, you know, could kill your own children. So I guess that's how I started getting a first eye to celebrity things, because that's where celebrities, you know, were known for spreading, you know, misinformation about vaccines, right? And so that's how I kind of got involved with being interested in celebrity culture, because if that's what people are listening to, we have to know about it. We can't just dismiss it. We can't just say, oh, well, that's silly, because it's harming people. You know, this isn't something everybody's ignoring. People actually listen to celebrities. And yeah, I mean, whether it's somebody like Gwyneth Paltrow, who I like to call sort of the couture of snake oil, you know, she offers high-end snake oil that most people probably end up not using because it's overpriced. But it's no different than seeing a beautiful item on a runway. Someone's going to knock it off, and eventually it's going to appear on like the Gap or H&M. So she sets those trends. And so that's why she's important. But Dr. Oz tells people they should listen to mediums and as well as psychologists. And he tells people they should drink apple cider vinegar for I don't know what. I would never drink that. And I don't understand pushing supplements and things. And, you know, those are done by, you know, I mean, Goop has their own brand of supplements they sell. I don't understand why people would do that. I mean, I guess I understand money-wise, but I don't understand otherwise.
Well, since you've been in this game and trying to counter a lot of this medical misinformation that's out there, do you feel like it has gotten better or worse, or is it just difficult to quantify because there's simply so much information and misinformation out there?
Well, I think in many ways, it's about the same as it's been for the last 4 or 5 years. And so for the last 4 or 5 years, I think it's been worse. I think that with, you know, I think there was a bump when Instagram became kind of a thing, because that was a new way for information to fly around in very beautiful, attractive ways that make people look, right? And so I think that the problem with our 24/7 news cycle and social media, which is clearly 24/7, is that there's this phenomenon called the illusory truth effect, and we all mistake repetition for accuracy. So what happens is you see this ridiculous headline about drinking apple cider vinegar to balance your pH, which you and I know is nonsensical, and you maybe hear it on a TV show or you hear Gwyneth Paltrow talking about it or whoever. And then People Magazine writes about it. And then that shows up in your Facebook feed and your Twitter feed. And then a bunch of influencers on Instagram write about it. And that shows up in your feed. And then your friends retweet and repost and all these things. And so by the end of 36 hours, maybe you've seen that headline 15 times or more. So it sticks with you. So I think that in the last 5 or 6 years, we've had more issues with that. But on the other hand, I do see more and more people maybe in the last year or two taking an interest in how they're consuming their news and understanding this concept of fake news. So maybe this is the spark that's going to be the light at the end of the tunnel.
Interesting, thoughtful answer. I really hadn't thought about Instagram, as I'm not really an Instagram user, and so didn't realize that. But that visual effect is something that's very strong. I want to talk about one specific Gwyneth Paltrow recommendation as a way to pivot toward your book. And this is something that may have been maybe her most egregious thing. I don't know. I don't really follow her or the Goop company, but it's the jade egg phenomenon. Can you tell us what that is and what Goop was telling women to do with jade eggs?
Sure. So you harness your feminine energy, man, through your vagina. That's how you do it. You're going to buy this polished hunk of jade and put it in your vagina. You're going to recharge it with the energy of the moon, though, right? As one does. and put that in your vagina. And maybe you were going to use it to do Kegel or pelvic floor exercises, but it was also going to somehow balance your hormones, which is a nonsensical statement because your hormones aren't balanced. And the idea was that this was, of course, a lost ancient secret from Chinese empresses and concubines known only to people in California. Isn't that funny how it skips anthropologists and archaeologists
yes.
and historians and appears in modern California? How does that work? So I wrote a post about that, just about how ridiculous it was. And if you want to do Kegel exercises, there's absolutely no data to show that using a device like a weight makes any difference. If you want to do it, sure, but use something that's medical grade silicone. Don't use, a jade egg that you have no idea how to clean. And, so I wrote that and apparently they didn't like that.
Yeah. So did that make you sort of public enemy number one with this brand, with Goop?
Apparently I'm known. People tell me things. People who know things tell me things. So apparently I'm the angry gynecologist. That's what I heard. So yeah, I'm rightfully angry. You shouldn't lie to people about how their bodies work. So I guess I became their public enemy number one, which was very interesting because I'm certainly not the first person who's criticized them. A friend of mine, Tim Caulfield, writes a lot about science exploitation, basically using science-ish terms and marketing. And he actually wrote a book a few years ago called "Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything?" And many news sites have taken Goop to task over things that they've written. Even Stephen Colbert had done some things on Goop. So when Goop was angry, though, they didn't attack a news organization, and they were upset about having all these critics, I guess. And they didn't attack a news organization. They didn't attack Tim Caulfield. What they did was they attacked me because I'm sure they thought that a woman with a blog was an easy target. How feminist. But they were wrong.
Yeah, that smacks of the kind of behavior you call out, which is this patriarchal behavior.
Their whole reply to me was filled with tone policing, and they called me strangely confident. And so this part-time yoga instructor who was recommending the jade egg practice was apparently not strangely confident. And so that was really, I think, an example of how, you know, misogynistic the site is, whether it's, you know, internalized or blatant. I don't know the answer. Someone would have to actually ask them. But, you know, to call somebody who, you know, I'm a medical doctor, I've done a 5-year residency in OBGYN because it's 5 years in Canada. I did a year of fellowship in infectious diseases, and I'm also board certified in pain medicine. So to call me, and for the last 25 years, I've run a clinic dedicated to the vagina and vulva. So to call me strangely confident is clearly, you know, a way to sort of try to sexually decredentialize me. But, you know, I'm not having any of it.
Very strongly and appropriately confident. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Jen Gunter, who is author of the new book, The Vagina Bible, and a New York Times columnist regularly writes a column called The Cycle for the New York Times. And Jen, your book, The Vagina Bible, is really a response, I think, to a lot of misinformation that's out there. You mentioned before the ID there about the vagina and vulva. That's probably as good a place as any to start. The book really introduces anatomy and terminology. So just remind our listeners some of the basics about women's pelvic health.
Yeah, so I really... you know, found myself in the office many times responding to women saying, how did I not know that? So I wanted women to have a textbook. I wanted all people to have a textbook about the vagina and vulva. And so I think the most important defining thing is that the vagina is the inside and the vulva is the outside. And it's true that colloquially we talk about the vagina being everything, but medically it's not. And it's important to know about that. So I think that's one of the big things that people don't know. I think many, many people don't know that the clitoris is actually a really large structure and you only see a very small part when you look visually at the vulva. So many people don't know that the labia minora are part of the sexual response cycle. And so I wanted everybody to know exactly how the parts work. I wanted people to know what the parts were, how the parts worked, how to make the parts work the way you want to, how to take care of the parts, daily maintenance, and what to do if the parts aren't working, kind of, you know, in that order. And that's how the book kind of progresses.
And you did such a good job with it because the chapters are pretty short. They all have takeaways or a bottom line at the end of them. You cover common sexually transmitted infections. And you do one of my favorite things, which is debunk a lot of medical myths. And just by way of a couple, I thought it would be interesting because it's such a hot topic here in Oklahoma where we are, where we now have medical marijuana. You have a very short chapter on cannabis. What's your bottom line conclusion on vaginal cannabis?
Well, I have a magic carpet outside. You should buy it for me. I haven't shown you that it works. I haven't shown you what kind of results you'll get from it, but you should buy it from me, don't you think?
Well, it sounds promising. Have you tested it in randomized controlled trials?
Isn't that great? Yeah, I you just need to take my word for you, my word that it works. So that's what I think about people who make claims about untested products. I think that, if you're and I appreciate that, obviously we haven't been able to study cannabis in a way that we should be able to give people the answers, but then you shouldn't be making claims about efficacy. If you think your product is so good, then you should be studying it. You know, the thing about cannabis for me is that we have no idea what the impact really is of vaginal application. We don't understand what the endocannabinoid receptors do fully in the reproductive tract. We don't even know if there are endocannabinoid receptors in the vagina. We know they are in the uterus, and we know that they're involved with conception, but we don't really know. So we don't know what the impact is of chronic stimulation, right? We don't know what the impact of these products are on the vaginal ecosystem. I can't tell you what the osmolality is of the cannabis-based loops because it's not recorded. So I can't tell you if it's a high osmolality and could be damaging. So I guess I would say that we don't know what we don't know. And this is buyer beware. People should not assume that these products are going to be helpful. It's always interesting to me how people are so willing to assume that something that's being offered as medicinal, cannabis, and I'm not talking about recreational use, I'm talking about you want to get a medical effect from it, that they're so willing to accept that, but then they're so without any studies, but then people say, well, Big Pharma's hiding studies, they haven't done anything. Well, at least Big Pharma does some studies, right?
Right.
So, at least I can, walk into any drug company that's making a product and I know that the pill will contain what they say, probably within a 1-2% margin of error, right? So it's just amazing to me how people give these wellness type of products a complete pass, and they would not do that to Big Pharma. I mean, if Big Pharma came up with a brand new product that said, they said, put this into your vagina and it'll treat your pain and we're not going to study it at all, people would be up in arms.
Yeah. Well, there's, I guess, something about that whole kind of natural label that people put on things.
The natural fallacy is very strong, right? That how can something, if I'm using something natural, it must be better for me medically and also makes me a better person. That's a very strong thing that that we have to know about in medicine. And I just think that what I hope that I do is I point things out. And so in the book, I walk people through about, what might happen with specific doses, the unknowns with cannabis in the vagina, the fact that actually your natural endocannabinoids go down when you're sexually stimulated, they don't go up. And, many performance enhancing drugs make people feel like they are performing better sexually, but they're actually not. I think alcohol is a good example of that. We don't know what we don't know. And it's really very much buyer beware.
Okay. I want to ask you about something you address in the book that is so common. And I hadn't really heard this terminology for it, but I thought it would be useful as a public service, which is the chapter on treating GSM. This is genitourinary syndrome of menopause that affects approximately 50% of women. So it's half of women. Tell us about GSM and I guess what people should think about it or do about it, if you can give kind of a blanket recommendation.
Yeah, so these are the changes that happen when women go through menopause, and they can certainly start earlier than your... So menopause is 12 months after your last period. So you never really know you're sort of in full menopause until, retrospectively, I guess. But these changes can happen as estrogen levels start to drop in your 40s, and everybody's different. So some people will never have any symptoms, none at all. They'll continue to have sex. They'll have no problems. They'll have no pain. They'll have no irritation. And other people will develop vaginal itching or vaginal pain, or perhaps a change in odor, pain with intercourse, vaginal dryness, incontinence, those types of things. And the majority of them are related to the drop in estrogen levels. And it is almost always 100% treatable. So if anybody is suffering with any vaginal symptoms after menopause, they should see their doctor. If their doctor won't help them, they should see another doctor, because there's absolutely treatment. And there's, you know, almost always this can be treated vaginally, which is completely safe. It's not absorbed into the bloodstream. I mean, we have so much data on the safety of vaginal estrogen. But sometimes some women will also need systemic estrogen, possibly for other reasons. And so it's good to see your provider and to get the treatment that you need. I think that as society, sometimes we have a hard time talking about postmenopausal women and sex. The idea is that, older women shouldn't be sexually active. But, I'm 53. I'm on estrogen because I've got a very strong family history of osteoporosis. So it's a good preventative drug for me. And I'm sure still having sex. So I'm just here to tell all the women out there listening that, if you're not having sex because you're menopausal and you're having symptoms, go see your doctor, because it doesn't have to be that way.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Jen Gunter, who's an obstetrician gynecologist, author of the new book, The Vagina Bible, and a regular New York Times columnist, where she writes a column called The Cycle that answers readers' questions about female health. And Dr. Jen Gunter, one of my favorite chapters is kind of the last chapter of the book, The Journal of Old Wives' Tales. And we don't have time to go into all of them, but I thought it would be fun to just read a couple of them and get your take on them. And one that's extremely common, I would say in almost in all age groups, from teenagers on, is birth control pills cause weight gain. I was pleased to hear that's not true.
Yeah. And this is really, as I said, medicine has dismissed women, absolutely. But this is one of the times they haven't. They've said, hey, let's study this, because women are reporting this. And what better way to study it than to compare it with a copper IUD? Right? So also a method, because you can't compare being on birth control pills and not using any contraception. There might be a difference in people who need contraception and people who don't, right? Behaviorally. So they said, well, we're going to compare women who get the copper IUD to women who get estrogen containing birth control pills. And the weight gain was the same at a year, both put on a little bit. So it sounds like that being in a life situation which requires a birth control change is associated with weight gain. It's not a pill-specific phenomenon.
Okay. Interesting. I really didn't know that, any of that, so I was glad to hear it. I wanted to ask another one that apparently is more common than I thought, which are the whole idea of coffee enemas. And you say, don't do coffee enemas for anything.
Yeah, there's a whole Facebook group dedicated to coffee enemas. Now you know. People tell me things, like I said. Didn't you know there's a doctor, I won't say her name because I don't want her to have any page clicks, who recommends daily coffee enemas for depression?
Ooh, no, I have not come across that, fortunately.
Yeah, and Gwyneth Paltrow had her talk at one of her wellness conferences. So there you go.
Huh.
So obviously it's a total, scam. Depression is not caused by low levels of coffee in your rectum. And it just goes to show how predatory some of this can be, because people are desperate. And, I think they had information about coffee enemas on Goop's gift guide last year, their annual New Year's gift guide.
I mean, above anything else, I just think, what a mess. Oy. Okay. Essential oils. Aren't these, I thought essential oils are just that. They're essential for good health.
Yeah.
What is an essential oil anyway?
Sure, some of them can smell nice, but you and I well know that many herbs and plants, or however you want to call them, can cause irritant reactions. And if these products worked, we'd use them. You'd recommend them as medicine, right? I mean, they might smell nice. You want to put some drops in a diffuser, you be you, as long as your allergist says it's okay, or your pulmonologist. Don't ask me about diffusers. I'm a gynecologist. I don't know anything about lungs. So don't put them in your vagina.
Okay. Well, I want to turn a little bit of attention to your column, which I just think is so wonderful. I mean, it really is an incredible public service, and you can read it you can get the New York Times, or you can read it on their website, or you can certainly Google Dr. Jen Gunter's name. But I don't know if you do the headlines or the editors do that for you. But I was going to ask you about a couple of your more popular or more read columns. And one we've sort of talked about in a different way with GSM, but it's the title of it was Treating the Incredible Shrinking Vagina. And really, that's another way of saying what is vaginal atrophy. And I think that that is another prevalent problem that occurs in a great number of women. Tell us what is meant by vaginal atrophy and what it means or what someone can do about it.
Well, that's really just genitourinary syndrome of menopause. So atrophy can be part of that. So we kind of all call it now under the umbrella term of genitourinary syndrome of menopause because that sounds nicer than atrophy. But yeah, that weekly column is called You Asked, and that's the one where people literally ask questions and I answer them. It's a regular old advice column. And I always think about that one as I'm sitting with somebody on a bus and I have two stops to explain their question to them. You know, I get out a little brief thing in case they're going to jump off the bus and then I give them a little longer explanation. And then if there's a little bit of extra time, I tell them what I think personally. And so that's that column. And then I also have my monthly column called The Cycle, which is kind of more about my personal exploits.
Yeah. Okay. I think I confused both of those and I'm sorry about that. So there's another one. There's another one that were widely read. I think one was how to stop a hot flash. So that's something I think listeners want to know.
Yeah. So hot flashes are menopause in general is a very topic that interests women, and that's actually my next book. It's called The Menopause Manifesto. But yeah, so hot flashes are big business, and you're not on Instagram, but they even advertise special pajamas to wear at night to stop hot flashes. You should see what comes on my Instagram feed because of what I write about.
Do those happen to be Tom Brady pajamas? No, I'm kidding because was another book.
I have no idea what
we
these
debunked.
They're special fabric, didn't you know, that can cool your body?
Oh.
it's pretty funny. I mean, not really because I could see how people would be desperate in the middle of the night and buy it. So yeah, I mean, hot flashes and night sweats are two of the common, what we call vasomotor symptoms of menopause. And basically, it's like your thermoregulatory zone is just messed up. It's taking signals and reacting inappropriately to sort of minor changes. For hot flashes, you know, there are really no effective herbal remedies. Although increasing dietary soy can be helpful for some women, lifestyle changes such as dressing in layers and avoiding warm rooms, but that's not always possible. I mean, I do fluoroscopy. I you know, work with x-rays, you know, for the people out there might not know what that means. And I'm in lead in a surgical gown. Like I can't take my layers off when I'm operating on a patient, you know? So, there are pharmacological treatments for, hot flashes as well, estrogen replacement therapy, as well as antidepressants, some antidepressants, and also gabapentin and pregabalin can also be effective. And so women shouldn't suffer if they're having symptoms and they're being dismissed. They should hopefully find another provider. And I always tell people that if you feel like you're being dismissed, go to the North American Menopause Society. They have a great app called MenPro. If you download that for free and you put in your symptoms and your basic information, they can tell you about some treatment options. And you can also find providers that are members of the North American Menopause Society.
Well, the name of the book is The Vagina Bible. It's written by my guest today, Dr. Jen Gunter, who's an obstetrician gynecologist and a regular columnist in the New York Times, where she writes the column called The Cycle and another one called You Ask that takes readers' questions. Jen Gunter, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated it.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.